Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/watsonassistant.
This is DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg.
We welcome in the guys. Good morning, Chris Canty. How are you?
Good morning, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Hanging in there. Doing the best that we can right now. And interesting that sounds like June 1, the commissioner, which is, a week from this coming Monday, a week from Memorial Day, we might have some news on the NBA. So, you know, they're going to wait until next Monday, and then they may hopefully drop some good news on us.
Yeah, it's exciting, Dave, because it feels like we're inching closer to having live team sports return. You know, we've got a weekend where you're going to have another golf exhibition with Tiger and Phil, Peyton and Tom Brady. But, I mean, that's just the prelude to live team sports returning. NHL sounds like they're solidifying their plans to make a return, NBA as well. So I'm excited, man. I think everybody is excited to actually have the return of sports, because I think that signals to society that we're getting on the other side of this pandemic.
I hope so. Good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm doing all right, Dave. I'm doing all right. Had a rough night, but I battled through.
What happened?
I'm back this morning.
There's always something. You know, it's never like, Chris, have you noticed it's never like, hey, good morning, how are you? I'm good. How are you? Good. It's always like, well, this happened last night. What happened last night?
Well, it's quarantine. I mean, you got good days and we got bad days. I mean, it was a good day until I got a couple text messages last night that, you know, hey, the turn on MSG, they're showing one of your games.
Oh, nice.
So I thought it would be nice, and I watched it. I mean, it ended up being a win. It was the Tampa Bay Islanders series when Tampa ended up winning the cup in 2004. It was the game we won, and I thought I would enjoy it. And then by the end of it, I was depressed for some reason. Can't
really?
Even watch it. I was depressed. I was
it made
sad
you miss
after.
It?
Everything about it. Like just thinking about the season, thinking about the missed opportunity, all of it. I got real problems, Dave. I got real problems. I think I made that official last night. I got real problems.
At 9:30 last night, that all kicked in. Like that was evident.
That all kicked in.
Been.
Yeah. Well, I know you say it, and I probably do have. I mean, clearly I have some problems, but I was like, this should make me happy, and nothing about it made me happy at all. Not one thing.
I'm sorry.
No, actually, I take that back. There was one thing.
The win must have made you happy.
Well, the win made me happy, but we didn't win the series. What aggravated me is I went back to game one, which is the game we should have won, and we would have had a 2-0 lead going back to the island, and maybe we end up winning that series. That's what aggravated me. It made me even more mad. The one thing that made me smile, though, was it was Levy and Darren Pang doing the game. And At one point during the game, they start talking about, I don't know how many, I think Tampa had 8 or 9 power plays in the game. But guys were accentuating, you know, getting, you know, slashed or whatever it is. And at one point, Panger goes, what's going on out here? You take the slash in the face, and you keep playing like a man. Like, sports have come such a long way.
You just take the slash in the face.
Yeah, you take the stick in the face, and you get back to your business. I don't understand what's going on out here.
Santi, can you clip that for me? Thank you. I appreciate that.
I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
I started laughing. Kess like, what are you laughing at? I was like, you would never hear that in the game now. Just take the high stick in the face and just keep playing.
Yeah, that is a little bit over the top. All right, so let's get into it. I'm reading an article, I don't know if you guys have seen this, on ESPN.com right now. It says if there is no college football, there's no reason to believe that there won't be any, but if there is no college football, did you see the number that collegiate sports would lose? I mean, it's crazy. $4 billion if there's no college, at least $4 billion if there's no college football. You wonder why they're so desperate to get this thing up and running. I mean, this is a huge amount of money.
No, it's a large amount of money, Dave, and I had a conversation with my folks about it this morning and just trying to put themselves in that situation. If I was at UVA during this time, would they feel comfortable with me going back to campus for voluntary workouts? And I say voluntary with air quotes, and they said they would be very uncomfortable with it. Now, I get that the ultimate decision is going to lie with the athletes, but I just feel like they're taking an unnecessary risk with asking the kids to come back this summer, especially when you don't have regular students on campus. Now, we'll see what happens with the fall semester, but right now, students aren't on campus at these universities. So why are they asking the kids to come back and take part in whatever strength and conditioning workouts that they're going to organize? I'm uneasy about the whole thing, and I go back to the comments that Lincoln Riley made a couple of weeks ago where he said, you know, we're only going to have one shot at being able to pull this off this fall. Let's try to buy as much time as we possibly can, gather as much information as we can, so we can come to the best decision on whether or not we're going to have football this fall, and if we are, the best way to be able to keep these athletes safe.
Yeah, it's no surprise, too. It's football and basketball. I mean, the two biggest money-making
sports. Well, those are the two main sports in college.
Yeah, again, but it goes back to, I mean, we all realize, Chris said air quotes, but voluntary. It's not, I mean, they're not voluntary. I mean, this is, you're going to be expected to be, you know, to be at those workouts. That would be the expectation. I don't know if it's just me or if you guys agree with me or not. I just get the feeling, the more I hear about college football and, you know, you got the NCAA and Mark Emmert, you know, saying one thing and we realize it's, I mean, it's all lip service because he has no real power anyway. I feel like of the sports looking to return at some point or needing to return at some point, I feel like if anyone could screw this up, it's going to end up being the NCAA. We'll find a way to screw this thing up because they're so desperate to try to get this thing back on track because of the amount of money and what it would mean.
$4 billion is endless amounts of money. And the thing is, there's such a trickle-down effect. We talked about it the other day. Furman, right, which is not a tiny school, although a lot of people up here probably don't know much about it, down in South Carolina. But they're a Division I school. I mean, their baseball program, done. Their lacrosse program, done. So, and it's sad to say, but if you start taking away football specifically and basketball as well, and seasons can't go on or they get, you know, minimized or whatever, it's going to have this trickle-down effect on so many sports in college athletics. And I'm not saying that it makes it right that you have to push it through. I'm just saying, like, a lot of people don't realize how many people will be affected in college sports if only football doesn't bring in the normal amount of money.
No, there's going to be a lot of people affected, Dave, but I guess my whole point in, you know, this is whether, I guess the best way to frame it is this way, Dave. You recognize how much revenue that these sports bring in for these colleges and universities, but the fact that you would lose this revenue, I don't think that should be the burden that the college athletes have to bear.
Of course not.
For these schools. I don't think that should be the driving force as to determining whether or not we're going to have college football or college basketball in the fall semester. I just think that's the part of it that feels a little bit off to me. There's a conflict of interest when you look at the NCAA because they're the entity that's supposed to protect the student athletes, but they're also the entity that benefits the most from these sports resuming and having college football and college basketball. So I just think that there could be a situation where they're making a decision that's not necessarily in the best interest of the welfare of the athletes. And that's the part of this that just doesn't feel right to me. When we start talking about team sports resuming at the professional ranks, you understand that the athletes have a body that's protecting their interests. You have players' unions, and you have adult athletes that are making decisions based on what's in their best interest. So they can determine whether or not the reward is worth the risk. With college football, I mean, there's no reward for the players if they're going to take an abnormal risk because of this pandemic and try to play this fall. That's to me the piece that you can't really justify unless the health officials deem it safe for these college sports to actually take place. Guys, I just feel like this is not necessarily the time to be trying to make this decision. I think that they could have bought themselves some more time by delaying it another month and seeing where we're at in July, but to make the decision now to try to bring kids back on campus, it feels premature.
You know what I don't like about it? It feels like a complete cluster. A cluster, you know what? Like, I mean, there's no consensus. I mean, you're going to end up having, I'm sitting here watching ESPN now, you're going to have, you know, Ohio State open on June 8th for players to come back, and you got, you know, Ohio State's AD talking about having, you know, if rules are relaxed up to, you know, maybe 50,000 fans in seats. Ugh. But it just, there's no rhyme or reason to it. Like, if we're talking.
Oh, there's a reason.
Well, I know what the reason is, but I mean, we're talking about NBA, NHL, the NFL, and we're talking about Major League Baseball and college football. You would imagine because you're talking about kids. I mean, these are kids.
And amateurs, right?
Exactly right.
In theory, amateurs.
Yeah, but I mean, part of what you're tasked with as a college football coach or hockey coach, whatever it is the safety and well-being of these parents' kids. That's when you sit in someone's living room and try to get that kid to come to your school, you're selling to the parents, I mean, the safety of their child, the well-being of their child. So of all the sports trying to come back, you would think, because that's of the utmost importance and these are amateur kids not getting paid, that you would have a much more cohesive group making these decisions as opposed to it feels like the wild, wild west.
It
is. If we can play games and you can't, well, sucks for you. We're going to play games. I mean, it's because and again, because you need 6 to 8 weeks to get these kids ready, and, you know, God forbid we push the season back, that we're going to rush to get this thing going and we're going to bring these kids back and, you know, fingers crossed, it all works out. I don't like it.
I don't like it either.
You could.
Because that'll shut everything down. I'm telling you right now, if God forbid, worst case scenario, when making decisions, you have to always think of the worst case scenario. If God forbid the worst case scenario happens with one of these college athletes that gets called back in to have these workouts or whatever it is, and they start this thing up, like Lincoln Riley said, too soon, and one of these kids passes away because of this, it shuts it. Everything is going to get shut down.
Well, Rick, not even if one of these kids passes away, but if one of these kids gets it, I mean, at that point, you have to ask yourself, is it worth it to risk the well-being of these kids in order to try to move forward? Like, that's the thing. Like, I just don't understand why you would put these kids at risk. They're not professionals. They're not employees of the university. You're saying that they're amateurs. So why would you then ask them to risk, well, to take an abnormal risk, an unusually high risk, based on where we're at with this health crisis? Why would you ask them to do that when they're not getting compensated for it? Like, at least when you have professional sports, you have these unions that can negotiate with the owners and they can outline the precautions that they're going to expect them to implement in order to try to keep everybody safe. You don't have that with the NCAA. They're not going back and forth with the players. They're going to tell the players how it is. And guess what? Because the players really don't have a body that protects their interests, because they're not as organized, they're probably just going to accept whatever the colleges and universities tell them to do. That doesn't seem like it's right. That doesn't feel like it's right. And that's why I don't understand why they're rushing to try to make these decisions now. They have time.
Heather Dinich covers college football for us on ESPN. Does a really nice job. She was on Get Up this morning. And you mentioned it, Rick. What happens if one of these kids gets it? She says they really have no clear answer on what happens if a player coach tests positive.
The one question that nobody seems to have a concrete answer for at this point is what happens if a student athlete or a coach tests positive. Jeremiah Donati, the TCU athletic director, told me absolutely quarantine for 14 days. He asked his coach, Gary Patterson, what happens if you get sick? And he said, I got that emoji where the brain explodes looking back at me. So this is a real conversation, and a lot of people, most people I talk to, aren't sure what the answer is to that.
I get it.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's wonderful. You're talking about Ohio State opening up on June 8th, and they have no idea what they'll do.
You know what I thought she said was interesting, too, and the NFL is going to have the same issue? Maybe not as much, because maybe there'll be more testing available, like guys will be tested more often, which probably doesn't make sense either, because, I mean, again, we're talking about the well-being of kids that aren't being paid to play. Is she made a point this morning. So when you start talking about, you know, one of these players, right, like if someone's bound to get COVID-19, right, like we realize that.
Yes.
It's a foregone conclusion.
Just the odds are statistically that someone's going to get it, yes.
Okay, now you start to trace, you know, who that player's been in contact with. So she made the point this morning. So let's just say, for example, your quarterback gets COVID-19 and you start tracing this thing. Well, now he's in the quarterback room with the rest of your quarterbacks and your quarterback coach, your offensive coordinator. So what happens now if all your quarterbacks end up with this? Well, you got to quarantine all your quarterbacks. So now what do you do? You start forfeiting games because you don't have a quarterback?
No, you start playing a running back and quarterback.
I mean, is that what we're doing? I mean, so what happens in the NFL? So is there no quarterback room in the NFL just to keep at least one of the guys separate from...
What's that show with Kiefer Sutherland? Where they have all of Congress and everyone goes and right, and he goes into the other area just in case something happens.
Designated survivor, is that what it is? Yes, designated survivor. Yeah,
right. So you have the quarterback designated survivor.
Do you split them up? I mean, it would make sense, right?
Right.
Like, I mean, the backup not be a part of the quarterback room.
Daniel Jones and Colt McCoy can never be seen together.
It would make sense.
Oh, it's so bizarre, though.
And then how do you do the college playoff if one team? You know, if one team can play 10 games and the other one plays a full season, and you have one team that played 10 games that's undefeated and the team that played their full schedule is, you know, has two losses. How do you weigh that? It's a mess. The whole thing sounds like a mess.
Well, it is a mess. So it sounds like it is what it's going to be.
Well, the thing that feels a little bit off here is that the NCAA doesn't feel like they have institutional control, right? It feels like what happens at these colleges and universities is going to come down to what the presidents of these colleges and universities ultimately end up deciding. And based on where they're at and the circumstances surrounding them, I think that lends itself to each one of those presidents potentially making different decisions. And when you don't have that uniformity, how can you have any confidence that you're going to be able to protect all the athletes that are going to be involved in playing games this fall? You can't.
You can't. And how many players are on a college football team? There's like 100.
Over 100. Yeah, it's over 100, Dave. I mean, they have, what, 85 scholarship athletes in Division I? And then you have all the walk-ons. So, yeah, there's a lot of kids on this team. You're talking about trying to get a lot of kids to do the right thing, and that's a problem in its own right. You got teenagers and young 20-somethings, and you're going to ask them to be disciplined and go from where they're staying to the practice facility and nowhere else.
We can't get pro athletes to do the right thing. We're going to get kids to do the right thing?
But that's the problem in all of this, Dave. that's why it doesn't make sense to me to try to make this decision when we still don't have reliable treatment methods, when we still don't have a vaccine for this virus. I'm not saying that we're not going to be able to move forward because we don't have those things. But when it comes to college football, it just doesn't feel like we should put these kids at that kind of risk because they're not at a point in their lives where I think they can understand the gravity of the risk they're taking.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's a weird, tough, difficult situation. Well, I don't know what the right answer is.
There is no right answer, but you know. I mean, it's about the $4 billion that you're talking about.
I know exactly what
it's sad. I mean, but it's the reality. I mean, it's the reality of why the NBA wants to get back, why the NHL wants to get back.
But Ricky, you talked about this a couple of weeks ago. What I don't understand, if you're college football, is why you wouldn't be willing to push the season back to
the spring,
say the spring semester. Because you were talking about how important the gate is and all of the other revenue that's generated on Saturdays with actual game day, with people coming to the stadium. You have a better chance of being able to have stadiums at capacity in the spring of 2021 than you do fall of 2020. So why wouldn't you just decide to push it all the way back? What's lost there? To me, if you give yourself the maximum amount of time, I think it lends itself to you being able to, you know, come closer to what you would realize financially from a college football season.
Well, because that makes so much sense, it would all boil down to money. There would have to be some financial benefit of having the game start when they're scheduled to start as opposed to pushing it to the spring. Otherwise, we've been saying it for weeks. That makes the most sense.
It makes so much sense.
Well, it makes so much sense because, I mean, we've already had, you know, we had good news on Monday with a vaccine. I mean, you have the smartest people in the world trying to develop this thing. And the more time you give yourself, the more there exists the opportunity that they do come up with something that allows you to have, you know, a regular, you know, representative season with people in stands. And you'd be able to, I mean, there'll still be a risk because no vaccine is 100%, but, I mean, with the least possible amount of risk. So it makes perfect sense, which makes me believe that there's got to be some kind of financial ramifications by pushing the season back to the spring.
800-919-3776. All right, people lined up, want to talk about this, and Columbus talking about, Ohio State talking about, well, we'll have 20, 30, maybe up to 50,000 fans in the stadium. The whole thing, it feels like we're living in a bizarre world. Let's get to some of the calls, 800-919-3776. Joe in the car, lead us off, Joe. You're on 98.7 ESPN.
Hey, how you guys doing? Big fan of the show. I wanted to talk about how Old Dominion, I guess, is losing the men's baseball program. It's only going to get worse for Johnny Baseball, Johnny Wrestler, Johnny Track because of Title IX. At the end of the day, if they're going to start cutting, the only sports that are going to be left are men's football, men's basketball, and all the female sports. So Title IX, in a sense, is killing everybody else. That's all I got to say.
That's not true. It's not going to be basketball, football, and all the female sports. That makes absolutely no sense. It's never been that way. Title IX is to get females equal opportunity, but it's not going to be female sports over the male sports. It's supposed to be in addition to the male sports.
So I don't know, but to his point, I mean, to his point, which I don't agree with his point, and neither do you. But I think to what he's, I guess, trying to get at, I don't even want, maybe who knows what the hell he's trying to get at. But I mean, there'll be long-term ramifications, right? Like you're talking about.
I agree with that.
But here's what I don't get. I understand, like, there are obviously, you know, certain schools that don't generate the same kind of revenues.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I guess to answer your question, Chris, about why you wouldn't push to the spring, maybe, I mean, because these schools need the cash flow. Like, they need to start the cash flow at a certain time to maintain the rest of their sports.
And you're probably right, but what I don't understand is why that burden falls on the athlete. That doesn't seem like it's right. And then beyond that, it just, I mean, we had Mike Ozanian on yesterday from Forbes Business, and he was talking about the Power Five conferences and how the television revenue that they're bringing in is enough to subsidize all the other athletic programs at these colleges and universities. I don't understand why we feel like we have to bring the student athletes back on campus and have them participate in the fall. We can still have a season. You can keep the integrity of the season intact and just move it to the spring. I don't understand why it's necessary to risk their welfare, knowing that we don't have reliable treatment methods and we don't have a reliable vaccine right now. And we have a much better chance of having that in place when we get to January, February of 2021.
Maybe it's our own fault for assuming that they're in better financial shape than they actually are. I mean, if you read the story about the Oakland A's not paying, I mean, they're not paying their rent, and it's $1.5 million. And you're like, how can a professional baseball team not afford to pay, you know, $1.5 million? I mean, some of them are in worse shape than we would imagine. That need the revenue now.
I mean, you're probably right, Rick. But I guess when you start looking at how much college athletics has been making year after year after year to be in this position, I mean, it's ultimately, if you're not able to survive this as an institution, then I feel like that's on them. That shouldn't be on the athlete. You know what I'm saying? Like, they have a free workforce, and they hide behind amateurism and trying to say that these players are students before they're athletes, when the reality is the NCAA is just interested in how much money each athlete that's on scholarship can generate for them. And so to ask them to take on more risk and not have any benefit in there other than tuition and room and board, to me, that just doesn't feel right.
Well, it doesn't feel right because it's not right.
It's not right.
It's not right. But, I mean, you talk yourself in circles trying to make it make sense. Because
we're trying to square the circle and it's not working.
Yeah, no. It's not going
to
happen.
It'll never make sense. Like, we could sit here until we're blue in the face. It's never going to make sense to bring back amateur sports in late August. Just won't make
wrong.
Sense. It never. Well, it never will.
You're not wrong. But I mean, again, what I don't like about it, and I realize at some point, I mean, this is just where we're at as a country in business and the economics and everything else. At some point, you're going to have to take on some risk. We all get that. What I don't like about this whole situation is this is the safety of kids that aren't being paid to play a sport. Yeah, they get, you know, tuition and board and everything else. What I don't like about it is that it doesn't feel like you have everyone on the same page. Because you don't, and no. I don't like that. Because it would just, for me, if you have, you know,
or have Ohio one State, voice that's dictating everything.
Yeah, because then, because all you're doing now is just, you're putting yourself in a position where, because you have all these different opinions, and you have all these schools, these conferences doing their own thing, is that now I think you create more opportunities for there to be mistakes made. And all it's going to take is one mistake to affect everybody that's involved in this. You can't have Lincoln Riley, right, who's, I mean, one of the best coaches in college football, in one of the best programs in college football, say it would be crazy to have the kids back on campus in June and then have another of the biggest college programs in the country now turn around and have kids on campus mm-hmm. on June 8th.
Yeah, in 2 weeks.
I don't understand how that makes any sense.
That makes sense. It never will. It never
one
will.
School says it's crazy, and the other one's like, nah, you're yeah. wrong.
And the we other one is putting a plan in place of how they can get 50,000 people in the stadium.
Yeah, it's crazy to me. I mean, there has to be – something has to be done as far as, you know, trying to have – and who knows what that ends up being. But to try to get everyone on board with trying to find what's in the best interest of the whole and, more importantly, the kids that are involved as opposed to what's in the best interest of – my school and how much money my school can make having sports restart.
Well, let's go to Jimmy in Staten Island. Jimmy, you're next up on 98.7.
Hey, what's going on? Good morning, fellas.
What's up, Jimmy?
What's going on? I was listening to what you guys were saying, and I'm pretty sure, Chris can agree with me, and I'm pretty sure a couple of you guys that are, you know, athletes in general. I just think that it's disgusting right now. It's really sad. And we're not even close to having a vaccine yet, you know. And you having these guys, these athletes. I'm 26 years old, you know. I'm not too far away from being out of college. You got these athletes, and you know some of these colleges are surrounded by nothing. So these kids are gonna have nothing but to go outside. And how's that practicing social distancing? Or you know you're gonna have these kids that you know they just don't care, you know, and they're going out there, and then what? Understanding for them to sacrifice themselves for a couple of bucks and not even give them hazard pay. You understand? This is the NCAA being greedy again. At least give these guys something, accommodate these guys something, you know, to be outside and, you know, be playing a sport, you know, and then what? They get sick and then what? You understand? Like, it just sucks. Like I said, being a former athlete, you know, you see where it's going, you know, with the money wise and, you know, everything's surrounded by money. Everything is, you know, it's going to come down to money. But at the end of the day, you know, nobody's saying that it's a problem with it, but let it be close to having a vaccination. You understand? We don't even have that yet. You know?
Yeah, but I don't know how close we are to that, and I don't think they're willing to, and thanks to the call, willing to wait. Now, obviously, they're not, right? It's not even – I don't think they are. They're not willing to wait until February to start college football season. They've made that abundantly clear, Chris.
Yeah, so why should they jeopardize the health of the kids if they're just going to be impatient? I mean, to me, the news that has been coming out – on the treatment front and the vaccine front has been positive. Like, we've got the best minds in the world all working together to find a solution and to try to win this war once and for all. And I just don't understand why, if you're college football or college basketball, you would try to rush to get these kids back on campus and get these kids, you know, back working toward, you know, starting the season in the fall. It just doesn't make sense because you don't have to do it. You know, this is not something where you absolutely have to do it right now. You can wait until July to make a formal decision, but that's not what they're going to do. I think it's the SEC. They're having the commissioner and the presidents meet today, and they're going to determine, you know, when they can have kids back on campus for voluntary workouts. They're going to issue a recommendation, but it just seems like it's a little bit too soon to have these kids actually back on campus when you don't have students on campus. Now, Mark Emery came out a few weeks ago and said they're not going to have fall sports unless these campuses are open. Now, you have to put open in air quotes as well. We'll see what the definition of that ends up being. But if you're not going to do it, if you're not going to play games in the fall when campuses aren't open to students, well, why would you have the student athletes come back in June when the campuses are not open?
Yeah, it's college sports, college athletics. All right, let's take a quick break. Jim Rooney is going to join us. Dan Rooney's son wrote a book about his dad, A Different Way to Win. Interesting read. We'll get to that next. Bill Barnwell at noon. And, Rick, I'm going to tell you this now before we break. We're going to break in a moment. There's no easy way to tell you this, so I'm just going to come out and say it. Paul Feinbaum, 2 o'clock on Barton Hunt.
Yeah, I would have rather you not even tell me that.
But I had to, because I had to tease it.
Yeah, but why? I don't understand why. I mean, this was supposed to be, I mean, we're ESPN New York as a team. I mean, don't they know? I mean, Feinbaum's our guy.
Yeah, well, it seems like all the rules are off.
Take the stick in the face, and you get back to your business.
Right.
Wow.
Jim Rooney's going to join us. That is the proverbial stick to the face. want to remind you, you can listen to us anywhere. Just click Listen Live at ESPNNewYork.com. Find 98.7 ESPN on the ESPN app or the TuneIn app, or simply tell your smart speaker, play ESPN New York. At 98.7 ESPN New York, we go where you go. Jim Rooney joins us now. Dan Rooney's son wrote a book about his dad called A Different Way to Win. We welcome you in on this Thursday to 98.7 ESPN. Hope you and your family and everyone, Mr. Rooney, are doing okay.
Gentlemen, thank you. We are doing well, and we've been thinking about a lot of folks in New York. I have a brother that lives just north of you folks, and Bill Cowher stayed in the city. So we're thinking of everyone up there, but thanks. And I like the song you introed me in here.
We knew you would. That's why our technical engineer decided to play it right off the bat for you. So let me ask you this. You write the story about your dad. Did you learn a lot about him? Or like doing interviews and going around and finding out stories about him? Or are these things you basically knew and you just put pen to paper?
Well, you know, we wanted to try and tell a story about, you know, how do you be a good guy and win? And A, is it possible? And B, kind of, did he prove that? And I think, you know, overall in his life, he showed that you can do both. And you know, plenty of failures and fumbles, et cetera, along the way. But you know, I think when you look at the Rooney Rule and at least getting it started, when you look at how he transformed the Steelers and the way he did that, when you look at his work in Ireland as ambassador and even prior to becoming ambassador, you know, all those things he showed that, you know, he always tried to create the highest standards, work towards them, and always respected all the people around him. So that's what we tried to do. And you know, I think we found a story that proved that to be the case.
Jim, one of the words that gets thrown around a lot in professional sports, and we spend a lot of time talking about here on the radio with some of the teams that we cover, is culture. And some people, you know, Chris and I played professional sports, so we know exactly what that's all about, but some people don't really know what culture is or what it means to have a great culture and how important it is. I mean, that's something that you do as part of your living. I mean, could you explain to our listeners, you know, why culture is so important and for you, you know, how to create that winning culture?
Well, you know, I think it's the most important piece of any organization. You know, I think there's more to it than a lot of times gets discussed. I mean, I think it's, you know, taking your beliefs and moving them to outcomes and all, sort of all the steps along the way, the way you relate to folks, the processes, et cetera, that you have, processes and procedures, and then how you build your teams and the people you surround yourselves with. But fundamentally, what my father did was, you know, a couple simple things. He was very authentic. You know, when you look at our coaches, we had three coaches in 50 years that he hired. You know, Coach Knoll, very quiet guy, but great teacher. Coach Cowher, one of the you know, most inspirational people you ever meet. Coach Tomlin, just down to earth, very frank, lets you know where you stand. Each of them, though, he had, you know, he had the vision of how he wanted the organization, but allowed them to find their way to fit their process to that. So that was one. He always played the long game. He looked as far down the horizon as he could. And then everyone we talked to, you know, what was the first thing you think of when you think of Dan Rooney? And it was always do the right thing. So, you know, he tried to do the right thing. So those, you know, those are three things that I think in his culture and hopefully we still have them, you know, that's what really made the difference.
Jim, the Rooney Rule has been in the headlines going back to late last week when the proposal was floated out there about teams being incentivized with draft picks for hiring minority coaches and general managers. What is your overall feelings on that proposal?
Well, there were a couple proposals, as you know, so I like where we got to with two in the pool. You know, the idea that you have more than one candidate, one minority candidate, I think really does change the mindset, and all the science shows that it helps people sort of look beyond their biases. So I'm glad we did that, at least for the head coaching position. I like that we went to the coordinators and the assistant coaches, that there's now going to be a Rooney Rule requirement there, and then I like that in all of the jobs, we're including minority and women candidates for, you know, office jobs, PR jobs, et cetera. So that's good, and I think we should celebrate that we made progress this week. The proposal that you're talking about, this incentive motion, you know, clearly it offends a lot of people, and you know, certainly from a Rooney standpoint, we don't want to be doing things that are humiliating to people. The other side, I don't know if there's an other side of it, but the thing that we have to keep in account, though, is there has to be some sort of enforcement mechanism. And all data shows that if you look at long-term sustainable change, you know, punishments can help you in the short run, but in the long run, you need people to be motivated by positive things. So this clearly, you know, doesn't seem to be the right fit, and I think people are talking about that. But we have to find a way to enforce this, because if you don't have an enforcement mechanism, you're basically enforcing the sham interviews, because you're telling people it's okay to do those things.
Jim Rooney with us here, 98.7 ESPN. The book is A Different Way to Win, about his dad Dan Rooney's story from the Super Bowl to the Rooney Rule. You can buy it on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. Walk us through the beginning of how the Rooney Rule actually came to fruition. Was there a lot of opposition? Did your dad have to fight tooth and nail for this? Was it easy to put through? Walk us through how this whole thing started.
Well, you know, I go back in the book and I talk about, you know, from 1968 to 1976, the Steelers drafted more players from the HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, than any other team. We actually doubled the league average. And you have the stars, you know, Mel Blount, Donnie Schell, John Stallworth, who went to Hall of Fame, but so many other guys who contributed to those great teams in the 70s that won four Super Bowl championships, you know, had come from this different experience. And it was something my father believed could happen, but I think proving it out showed him that, you know, not only is it sort of the right thing to do to expand the pool of talent and to give people who aren't getting opportunities, but if you do it right, you can have a competitive advantage. And so he saw that in that case, and he felt like, you know, Tony Dungy was part of that team and was our defensive coordinator back in the 80s. You know, you get to the situation where Tony's fired, and my father and a whole host of other people were involved and said, look, this is, we're just, you know, we're not going in the right direction. So then you have the rule, and really for the first 15 years while my father's still alive, it's going in a good direction, and he's really the chief advocate and does a lot, you know, does a lot to make those initial changes and have them, you know, have some of the numbers we got. And then, you know, ever since he passed away, John Wooten, who was really important, one of the first African-American scouts, who was sort of, you know, my father's partner in advocating for these efforts, retires. So you had several things sort of happen at once, and you get to the point where you are now where, you know, the numbers just aren't where they should be. We should have more than four head coaches and two general managers, that are minorities in the NFL.
Jim, and this is just, I mean, you obviously, you know, with your relationship to your dad and everything else, how do you think your dad would feel about, you know, where we're at as far as the Rooney Rule is concerned?
Well, I think a lot of things I've said he would feel, you know, he would be frustrated that we even got to this point. But once we're there, he was always a solutions based guy. And I think he would like what happened this week. I think these are, like I said, they're good steps, but then the push on the things we said, with enforcement. I think we have to think about, you know, leadership in a different way. You know, you had one guy who really took this on, in my father, and there certainly were people who supported him, but you had one guy at the ownership level who's a very loud advocate. I think it's going to be different now. I think you're going to have multiple voices. We have more women at the ownership table than we ever have, and I'm hopeful and believe that their voices, are going to push this effort. So, you know, I think he would feel good about the potential, but my father was also, you know, as I said, you know, he was a good guy and treated people well and was famous for that, but he also was an outcomes guy, and the outcomes aren't there. So, you know, he would expect all of us to be getting to those outcomes.
Jim, it's being reported that Mike Tomlin will speak on a virtual development session in front of the NBA coaches on May 27th for an equality initiative. I guess my question in that is, how much does it mean to you, your family, and the organization that you have your head coach as an advocate for diversity in sports at the highest level?
Yeah, Mike is one. He's just excellent, and he's going to do a tremendous job whenever whenever I'm in Mike's presence and he's giving a speech. You know, I feel ready to go. You know what I mean? He's just fantastic at that, in those types of forums. But I think it really talks to the culture and the idea that you know, we've tried to create this sense of belonging, and Mike has come in and has excelled. And you know, Mike, like Bill and like Chuck before him, faced challenges, but we tried to create an environment where we're part of those challenges with them. And I think so many times, you know, people want to stay out of the challenge and let their coach or let someone else sort of struggle through it. And I think that's, you know, you guys talked about culture at the beginning, and Mike has made our culture better because of you know, that sort of symbiotic relationship. And I think he's going to speak to, you know, not just sort of the diversity angle, but really creating, you know, those environments where there's a true sense of belonging, where everyone's voice, you know, should be heard. Doesn't mean you're going to go in that direction, but that type of environment where people really feel empowered, where they feel like they belong, where they feel like they can make a difference. And Mike has done that for us. So the fact that he's going, you know, out into the world and speaking to it, is, as Mike would say, he needs no endorsement from me, but, you know, we're certainly proud to see it happen.
Jim Rooney with us here, 98.7 ESPN. How involved are you with the Steelers organization now?
Well, my brother's the team president. I have a brother who's a scout. My job, you know, is the easiest job in the world when I do work for the Steelers. You know, I basically am involved in engagement, which means I schmooze, you know, governors and VIPs when they come to the game, which is the worst job because none of them watch the game. I have to talk to them the whole time and then go home and watch it on a DVR. So, but we try to build that community relations component as something that we see is very important. And so, you know, I'm proud to be part of that. But I always laugh because, you know, what I'm doing keeps me away from getting a chance to watch the game so often.
Jim, and then you're talking about Mike Tomlin. I mean, it was funny having conversations about, you know, Mike after what happened with, you know, Antonio Brown and us dealing with Lev Bell. I don't know if he gets enough credit. I mean, he deserves a Nobel Peace Prize for keeping a lot of that behind closed doors. But, I mean, you talk about culture and everything else, and I just feel like we're at a time now in professional sports where there is no patience. I mean, you guys, the Pittsburgh Steelers, you mentioned only having three coaches. I mean, is one of the reasons why you guys had so much success creating, you know, the culture around this team is because you've kind of bucked the trend and had that patience, you know, with your coaches and given them the ability, the confidence that they're going to be around a while. So they'll have, you know, they'll have your support through, you know, the ups and downs and turbulent times too.
Yes. And that's really where I spend a lot of time in the book, is talking about my father's work, as we said, with the diversity initiatives. You know, he was the chief negotiator for the league on the labor, and the labor folks all talk about, look, Dan Rooney was on the other side of the table, but we knew we could trust him. His time in Ireland, you know, you're talking about, you know, what is sort of a quasi civil war situation there. And, you know, spent a lot of time and effort funding integrated education between Catholics and Protestants. And what he did was he stepped into the mess, and he always said, look, everyone wants to avoid the mess, and that's not how you get things done. That's not how you solve problems. You have to be willing to go into the tough times, stay there in many of these cases, you know, for many years, and continually work towards trying to make a contribution that's going to be positive, that's going to make a change. And you know, that is what my father did, and I think it, you know, when you look at it compared to other teams, and I'm not trying to, you know, criticize other teams, but you know, that ability to sustain has a lot to do with the patience, the resilience, and the willingness to step into messes and stay in the difficult situations, I think, longer than most.
Jim, how confident are the Steelers organization and folks around football that the season is going to start on time?
Well, you know, there's people a lot smarter than me making those decisions. You know, I think it's first going to come down to can we keep the players and the staff safe? And then if you're going to do something with fans, which the plan is to do that, you know, is their individual safety, you know, accounted for? And then is there a public health consequence? So, you know, I think there's some smart people making those decisions. And, you know, other than that, you know, we're going to move forward with what they tell us to do.
All right. Well, Jim, listen, we appreciate a couple minutes. Glad you and your family are safe. Glad the book is having success. It's A Different Way to Win, about your dad, Dan Rooney's story from the Super Bowl to the Rooney Rule. Of course, you can get it at Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. And we appreciate a couple minutes. Thank you so much.
Guys, thanks so much for having me, and stay safe.
All right. We really appreciate that, of course, is Jim Rooney. Interesting stuff. I mean, the Rooney Rule is something that's gone back a long, long time. and must feel tremendous pride in the contributions that his dad has made, both in the success of that organization and the success of the NFL, and really to try to, Chris, change the NFL for the greater good.
Dave, as far as I'm concerned, that's going to be the Rooney family legacy, is the Rooney rule in trying to advocate for diversity in the NFL at the highest levels. And we talk about how the NFL is a leader on a lot of different fronts in terms of issues that we face in this country. And inclusion continues to be one of the big things that we're fighting for in trying to get changed. And so the fact that this organization is prioritizing that and everything that they do, I feel really good about it. And so, yeah, I'm glad that we're actually having the conversations now about the Rooney Rule, and the proposal is kind of the genesis of all of it. But I think it's a necessary conversation, not just in sports, but where we are in this country.
Today on ESPN Daily, the NFL offseason is mostly in the books, and ESPN NFL guru Bill Barnwell is here to rank every team's moves. How does your team stack up? Hear more on ESPN Daily. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts, or listen to us right at noon as Bill Barnwell joins our show. In these trying times, important to remember, we pulled together as a community. Small businesses all over going to be feeling the lasting effects of this pandemic. If you are a small business trying to get the word out that you're still serving the community, let us know. Send us an email to 987ESPN@gmail.com and let us know your story so we can pass the word along to our community. All right, Rick, you ready for Andy and his questions?
I can't wait. I mean, this is the reason why I wake up in the morning.
Is it really? Just for Andy?
I need something. I mean, after the depression that hit me last night, I need something.
All right, let's bring him in. Andy, you heard the man. You're the reason he gets out of bed in the morning. You're on 98.7.
Good morning, guys, and Rick, I did watch the Islander Rewind last night. It was a fantastic performance. Steve Levy could not speak highly enough about your stick handling skills. So,
maybe sad, Andy.
And young Aaron Andrews in the sidelines as well, which was also very nice to watch. I was thinking hockey questions today, but I'm going to take it to the hardwood. We're going to do a little NBA for the three of you.
Ooh, look at you on a Thursday, a little hardwood. Nice.
Absolutely. CC, break out your purple and gold pom-poms. You ready?
I'm ready to roll.
Only one Laker in history has worn the jersey number 66. Relatively recently, and he didn't play a full season. Can you name him?
He didn't play a full season and wore 66.
Number one overall pick in the draft, Andy, yes?
Yes, he would have been.
Yes.
Huh.
Not from this country, Andy, yes?
Not originally from this country.
Not originally from this country. I have
I'm trying to help him. I love Dave.
Andy, I have no idea.
Dave, you want to help him out?
I have no idea. No, I'm going to say Andrew Bogut would be the answer.
That would be correct. Way to pick up your teammates.
Appreciate you, Dave.
I got you.
Yeah.
Rick.
This is, let me just say something quickly. Yes. Just so people understand what's going on here. Because Dave does this on Saturday on his own show. What this is, Dave having this segment in this show and having Stump Rothenberg on Saturday is the equivalent of Michael Jordan releasing The Last Dance. That's what he's trying to do.
But I don't think I'm making him look like Pippen. I'm trying to help.
No, no, forget it. No, there is no Pippen.
I don't feel bad that I didn't know the answer to that question and I'm a Lakers fan at all.
This is you trying to accentuate your greatness. That's what this is.
Okay.
Dave, when is Stump Rothenberg hurt on Saturdays, by the way?
10:30 Saturday mornings, Andy. Thank you for the plug.
You're quite welcome. Rick, my question to you is, who has committed the most fouls in NBA history?
Oh, my God. That's a tough question.
Yeah, of course it is, because I got two right. Now, all of a sudden, he wants to come at me.
You saved 22 out of 22 last night. You got nothing to be fearful of.
All right, give me a hint. Is this person like somebody that I should know? Is this one of the NBA greats that just so happens to have the most fouls?
Mount Rushmore players. He played for a very, very long time.
Does he also have the most points?
He is up there in most points.
Oh,
did he have a shot that was virtually unstoppable?
Virtually unstoppable.
Probably unstoppable. I'm going to go with one. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
You would be correct.
Oh, lovely.
Yes.
Lovely. Well
79
done.
79 more fouls than the mailman, Karl Malone.
the mailman doesn't deliver on Sundays. They didn't put that in the dog,
not.
I thought.
No, he does not.
All right, Dave, I'm giving you no layup here.
Oh, God.
Yours.
Wait, if you come into this saying this is no layup, this is going to be a brutal question.
This is a free throw question.
All right.
Only three players in NBA history have a career free throw percentage above 90%. Please name them.
Okay. I'll take my first shot with Mark Price.
That's number three.
There's one that seems just so obvious.
It's obvious?
Yeah, I mean, this, well, I don't know if I'm right, but it just seems, I don't know what the number is, but it seems like one current player is just obviously, I mean, he's that good a shooter, has to be on this list.
So you're saying Steph Curry. I'm going to say Steve Nash.
Number two.
And you think Steph is one?
Has to be?
All right. And Steph Curry.
Steph Curry is number one, DP.
Yes!
Man alive!
Yes!
DP with the assist. Guys, fantastic job. Stay healthy.
That was wonderful.
I like when we help each other. It makes me feel good.
It feels good, honestly. Doesn't it feel good when you get these questions right?
I love it.
Right?
Honestly, I love it. I mean, I can't even tell you. Here's the thing, though. As much as I love the getting them right,
when you get them wrong, it's
destroys me.
It doesn't feel good when you don't get them right.
But we got them all right.
Well, you got my question right, and I appreciate you for that. I'm continue to be impressed by how your mind works.
I'm here for you.
Yeah. I mean, Andrew just embarrassed me, and I'm a Lakers fan.
Yeah, but that's,
no, but that's not. That's a tough question.
I wasn't checking for Andrew Bogut rocking the 66. I just wasn't.
Wow, who wears 66? It's sacrilegious. That's Mario Lemieux's number. Stop.
That's right. By the way, the new Giants offensive guard, Lemieux, is going to wear 66 also.
David Deal's old number.
Yes. That is.
I kind of like that, though, the symmetry. I mean, his last name is Lemieux. He's wearing 66.
Yep,
Lemieux wears
66. That's right. It's perfect.
DiPietro, Catty, and Rothenberg. Weekdays at 10 on 98.7 ESPN.